My name is Beth Bosk. I'm the editor of New Settler Interview. My other full-time job is I'm being sued by LP. The following hour of Fourth Gate Gazette is brought to you by the members of KZYX and Endormant, with clothing in sizes 14 to 34W for the woman of substance as well as style, 450 Main Street in Mendocino. 2 hours of great conversation scheduled for you this morning. Judy Berry is here in the studio with me. She was one of the 10 women who violated the court order yesterday. I noticed that the sheriff of Mendocino County kind of ignored it himself. In about a half hour, we're going to be joined, maybe even before that, by two loggers who have great consternation about the demonstrations that are going on in the Enchanted Meadow area. That's Jim Murphy and Virgil Maxwell. They're going to dialogue with Judy. Judy Berry, you were one of the 10 women who, singing that song, marched down Road 16 and crossed across the orange line onto LP property yesterday.
Yes.
Let's talk about that action to begin with.
You want to talk about how it felt, or why we did it?
Yeah, why, and also why it was important for at least one day to have an action that was women and women only in order to express.
It actually wasn't put out as a women-only action. It's just that only women showed up to do it. We certainly would have welcomed men had they come, and we hope that next week 10 men will get arrested. But the fact that it was women was really appropriate and significant in Albion, because Albion is the place in this county where there's been a very strong history of strong women, a strong women's movement, and you know, if the Albion demonstrations are to really reflect the spirit of the community, it's important that the women be very well represented in it. And the other thing that was so neat about it to me, the people that got arrested, these were not imported demonstrators from the city. These were local people crossing the line in their own neighborhood, defending their homes, risking their livelihoods, risking their land, because we're tired of what LP's doing, and we're going to stand up to them together.
Right. And as ecofeminist Sharon DiBiago, one of the daughters of Albion, often writes, the hatred of the feminine is the hatred of nature.
Yes, or the hatred of life, particularly, is what she put it. And I do feel that there's an aspect of that. I don't think that I think we have to be distinguished between the feminine and the masculine, and males and females, though. I don't think that this condemns all males, that they're irreparably damaged, although this culture certainly does their best to do that. But I think that those values, I think there actually really are legitimately feminine and masculine aspects of people, and I think that both women and men contain both. But I feel that this society, and obviously the difference between men and women is that women give birth and nurture, and obviously that is a legitimate biological feminine aspect, which doesn't mean that men don't nurture also. But I think that this society does two things that help cause the destruction of nature and this just totally warped society we live in. First of all, they separate these two values, that, you know, boys don't do that and girls don't do that, that, you know, that we very polarize the natural feminine and masculine aspects of our culture, and assign only destructive and aggressive things to men, and then passive and nurturing things to women. And then on top of that, I think we only value the aggressive. I think we only value the male in this society, or they do, the dominant culture. So that a woman like myself, who is aggressive, a male trait, can be valued for her aggressiveness, but men are not valued for their nurturing, or women are, nor are women valued in this society for their nurturing. So I think that this problem of male and female is not so simple as men are bad, women are good, but I do think that the hatred of the feminine aspects of life giving and life nurturing, is certainly very strong in this culture and very connected to the destruction of the forest and the earth.
Over the past year, you have compiled an astounding dossier on Harry Merlo and LP in terms of their business intentions. I'd like you to talk about that, because there's been a real blackout of this information in the national press?
Okay,
and
well,
it's international information that you've uncovered.
Certainly it is. And I mean, I'm self-educated. I read every article I can get a hold of about LP. But another advantage that I have now been forced to admit this in court, so I might as well admit it on the radio, is that the Bob Morris papers, the LP papers, came through me. They arrived anonymously in my mailbox with a Sacramento address. I don't know anyone in Sacramento. And I have studied the actual memos, the leaked LP memos, in great detail and figured out what they meant. The language of them is very dense. And what was reported in the newspaper is that these memos from top-level executive Bob Morris to Harry Merlo, the president of LP, they were written over a three-year period. And what's been reported in the press so far is that these memos show that internally LP was admitting what they were denying publicly, and that is that they've been vastly overcutting in the Redwood region. But really, that's a very shallow analysis. That is only a tiny piece of what these papers were about. These papers were not environmental documents, they were economic documents. And I want to say that I tried to testify to this in court, and as soon as I started on it, they started jumping up objecting to every word. And although they had a very liberal policy towards letting people testify concerning their love of the forest, their use of the land, they wouldn't let me get a word out of my mouth. And I think the reason for that is they don't want people to know what was really in those papers. And what the papers consisted of, it's a series of 3 years in which Bob Morris becomes increasingly disillusioned with what's going on at LP as he figures it out. And eventually he condemns the company's business practices and is fired for it. The first of the memos is called Long-Term Timber Purchase Agreement. And it was written, I believe, in 1988. It's the first of the memos. And it was actually written by Bob Morris at Harry Merlo's request. Harry Merlo asked Bob Morris, apparently, to come up with a plan by which he, as an individual, could do a takeover of LP, similar to that done by his friend Charles Hurwitz of Pacific Lumber. So that what this was a plan for a private takeover of the public stockholders corporation LP. And what it says in the papers, it doesn't say he's not just going to come in and take over the whole company the way that Charles Hurwitz did. Harry Merlo is much more creative than that. What he came up with was that he, or the management group, as they call it in the papers, were going to buy out just the mills in the Western Division, and they were going to leave the woods to the stockholders. And what the plan of this was that that way the stockholders would think they were getting the good end of the deal. They'd think they would be getting what was valuable. Meanwhile, Harry was quickly liquidating everything in the forest while saying that the amount of timber left or cut was proprietary information.
He was scraping the landscape, in other words.
Oh, absolutely. And he was taking everything as quickly. As soon as this memo came out in 1988, that's when he began his logging to infinity plan and this very stepped up logging, where he began to quickly liquidate the part of the company that he intended to leave the stockholders with. Okay, and then simultaneously, he began to build up the value of the part of the company that he was going to keep, which was the mills. He invested $6 million in new mill equipment in Cloverdale, a similar amount in Samoa, and then he began closing those mills down with all this valuable equipment in it, therefore making it appear to the stockholders that the mills were the valueless part of the company and that they would be getting a good deal to spin off the mills to him, whereas in fact the woods were depleted and the mills were stocked with valuable mill equipment.
But if the mills are closed, what use the valuable mill equipment?
Well, and that's the final thing that really shows the depravity of this corporation and how little they care for our area. The LP is engaged in not one but two foreign ventures. Everybody knows about the LP mill in Mexico, and I've actually seen videos of that mill, and right now it consists of a huge empty building with one planing machine in. I believe they got the planing machine from the Potter Valley Mill. So where is this mill equipment going? Well, the mill that was disassembled in Potter Valley, the actual equipment was sent to Mexico. But you can be sure they didn't build this big empty building for one planing machine. Obviously, they're going to fill it up with other mill equipment. Where is that that mill equipment going to come from? Well, one possibility is the Cloverdale Mill, which just had $6 million worth of state-of-the-art mill equipment put into it 2 years before it was closed down. Now, what Bob Morris begins to notice, first he says, why are LP's business practices so inefficient and so nonsensical? And after a while, he begins to discover that they're not, that they're very deliberate, that what Harry is doing is putting value. There's no way that Harry Merlo did not know that he was going to run out of timber to run the Cloverdale Mill in 2 years when he invested that $6 million. So Morris begins to suspect Merlo of deliberately hiding value in the mills to finance his, to capitalize his overseas ventures. But it goes a lot further than Mexico, and I think that this is the, even the more ominous part of it. LP, and I believe GP also, but I'm certain that LP, has signed a contract to log the forest in Siberia. Now, in Siberia, 55% of the old growth left in the world is in Siberia. And this is not, by the way, a good timber-growing country where it will grow back easily. Taking this old growth is going to be devastating to the ecology. At any rate, so what they claim is that they're going to get the, well, there were other companies that bid on this also that wanted to get this wood as well as LP and GP, and Willamette was one of them. And in one of the articles in the business section, Willamette Industries comments, well, we couldn't get this contract because the Russians didn't want money for their trees. They wanted mill equipment. And when I saw that one, then that just rang a bell for me. Oh, well, gee, apparently what the Siberians want to do is they want to sell off a portion of their forest in exchange for mill equipment so that they can mill the rest of it themselves. And Harry wants to buy that portion of the forest with the mill equipment that he is putting into the mills here and then shutting down the mills. So essentially, he's liquidating the redwood forest. He's capitalizing the local mills with what he's getting out of the forest, putting in state-of-the-art equipment, closing the mills down with the option now of shipping that equipment to Siberia to pay for the trees. The next question is, where are these trees going to be milled from Siberia? Harry Merlo claims that they're going to be milled in Humboldt County, and I find this very hard to believe. I mean, if he's shipping redwood from here down to Mexico, why is he shipping fir from Siberia to here? It's the southern tip of Siberia, and if you look it on the map, it's actually closer to Mexico than it is to Humboldt County. And of course, the wages in Humboldt County, $8-$9 an hour, certainly exceed the 85 cents an hour that they make in Mexico. So I think it's quite unlikely that this wood would eventually be sawed here. I think the reason why they're saying they're going to saw it here is, first of all, to placate people from not noticing that we are being stripped and bled dry to capitalize a foreign venture. But secondly, because they're not set up yet in Mexico to do the rough sawing. They're sending rough sawn lumber down there. They're not sending raw logs down there. There's, because they don't have the setup yet. So I think that temporarily, he may mill this lumber in Humboldt County while he ships the Mendocino mill equipment to Siberia to pay for the logs. But I think that ultimately his plan is to mill the Siberian logs in Mexico. And this whole, it's a three-way foreign venture. He's liquidating the redwood region to buy the logs in Siberia, to mill in Mexico for him to reap more vast fortunes out of. As for his takeover plan, which I started out with, well, when I tried to testify to this in court, as soon as I finished describing the takeover plan, Cindy Mayfield, the LP attorney, popped up and said, you know, objection, she hasn't proved that this plan was ever implemented. And Luther, of course, ruled that I could not then describe it. Well, what I do think has happened is Harry began to implement that plan. He began to do what they do in corporate takeovers, which is you get all your ducks in a row, and then you move quickly for the actual takeover. And I think that getting his ducks in a row in this case consisted of liquidating the wood so the stockholders would buy an empty bag and not realize it, and hiding the value of the mills so that he could buy them for cheap. But I think that we busted him.
Do you think it's the LP memo leak?
I think the LP memo leak is a little late on that. Mm-hmm. I think we busted this plan for Harry to do this takeover. He's still doing the liquidation. Mm-hmm. He's still capitalizing LP's foreign operations at the expense of the Redwood region. But as far as the private takeover, I think we busted him with Redwood Summer, because when we made an international issue over the fact that there were no trees in Harry's Woods, then the stockholders would no longer, as it says in the LP paper, be easy to lead them to believe that that's where the value was in the woods. And I think this gives a whole different spin on it. You know, this has nothing to do with spotted owls. It has nothing to do with timber workers. It has nothing to do with environmentalists. It has to do with cold capitalism, you know, a corporate executive who cares only about money, cares not about our community, cares no more for the workers than he cares for the trees. And the fact that in this community we have spent some time fighting each other over these issues, I think is a shame. I think it's that a lot of people are now waking up. It's harder and harder to sell the lie. LP even admits that 90% of their trees are under 45 years old now. So, and while they say, well, those trees are growing, well, this is what they refer to as the timber gap. It would take at least 30 years for those trees to grow to be a sawlog. Really, a redwood tree makes a good sawlog, maybe at 120, but marginally at 70 years. So if you say that it's going to be another 30 years before this 90% of LP's trees grow up, well, what's going to happen to the mills in those 30 years? Are they going to leave them sitting there so that they can open them up 30 years later? No way. They're going to disassemble them. They're going to use them to capitalize and finance their to stock their Siberia operation and their Mexico operation, and then they're going to convert that land to real estate. Because if it's more valuable as real estate, there's no way that LP, who hasn't even been here for 30 years, is going to let their lands lie fallow for 30.
Already, Cindy Mayfield, LP's lawyer, is talking about the beautiful Enchanted Meadow and how pristine they've left it. I could just see the Enchanted Meadow Estates.
Right, there you go.
Waiting in the back room are two timber workers, two loggers, Jim Murphy and Virgil Maxwell. I'm going to bring them in to have a conversation with Judy and with you at home or in your shop. You're listening to Fourth Cake Gazette. My name is Beth Boss. In case you've just tuned in, or you're driving through. Hopefully, you're not skidding through. In the studio with me, Judy Berry, and we've just been joined by Jim Murphy and Virgil Maxwell. They're two loggers who showed up at the Y this weekend to hold demonstrate themselves, because their fear, and the fear of many of us, is that the lifestyle of the logger is going away in our North Coast communities, and many fear that vanishing. Welcome, gentlemen, to Fourth Cape Gazette. Jim, do you want to start us off? Tell us about that concern, and you want to get a little bit closer to that microphone. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us. And as we talked about earlier, the major issues that we heard you discuss earlier, I have no reference or am not real familiar with your issues on the Enchanted Meadows. What my concern was, and why we showed up at the Y, is there was nobody from the timber industry at all visible saying anything at all about the guys that actually work in the woods, that cut the trees down, yard the trees, the actual brute force and ignorance per se. I believe that lifestyle goes back in the United States history a number of years, clear to the foundations of America. And if that goes away, a whole bunch of history goes away, a whole bunch of our culture. So what do we do about it, you know?
Well, you know, this 280 acres are being near clear cut. They're saving 6 trees per acre now, the seed tree reclamation plan. But there are, as far as I can count, I mean, there are only 6 guys regularly employed in that 280 acre clear cut, and they were planning on plowing through that in a six week period, Jim. And I don't think that we have broken the back of the industry. I don't think that is really the burden of forest land activists. That's been accomplished by these multinational corporations themselves by putting in so much automated equipment in the mills, even by the kinds of equipment they've started dragging into the gentler slopes, like feller bunchers. How many jobs does a feller buncher wipe out?
9.
9. Virgil, do you want to add?
I'd like to congratulate this movement, the environmental movement, in its quest to find out what's going on. And I really feel that there's no contest between the working people and the environmentalists, that the basic issue here is what these corporations are doing to our forests and the way that they force the workers to log it in a style that they want it done rather than in a style that's conducive to an ongoing history of logging. So there's no contest here in these environmental issues that some changes need to be made in the methods of logging. The thing that inspires me is that this environmental group can see that the process is on a much higher level. It deals with the corruption that's going on within the businesses. It's not down here on the lines protesting or anti-protesting. It's all that can be negated with a few swipes of the hands and some big lawyers, which they're very good at doing. And so I congratulate Judy and the whole environmental movement in that they're on the right track.
Thanks a lot. I wanted to comment that the issue of the use of the forest, that's not what these protests are about. We agree on the use of the forest, and I believe personally that if we love and respect the forest, it will support us. And the people, although not employed by LP in the most part, there have been a few LP employees, actually. And yeah, the timber workers haven't been public for obvious reasons, but I know there's been an LP logger that helped rig some of the tree sitters. I know that there were two mill workers from Ukiah LP Mill that addressed one of our rallies. There was another mill worker who wore an Earth First t-shirt to work at the Ukiah LP Mill twice and got away with it in support of our demonstrations. And really what we're against is corporate liquidation logging. We're not against the working people. In fact, the people that we represent are working people ourselves. I was a blue-collar worker my entire adult life and worked as a carpenter until being disabled. Some of the people we work with, one of them owns a small sawmill, others are woodcutters, others are fishermen and women. You know, people that we're working with also live off the land, and I think that's what's unique about this community. In most places where they're successful at pitting environmentalists against timber workers, the environmentalists are actually privileged people from the cities who come into people's communities and tell them what to do. But in this community, we all live here together. You know, we're your neighbors, and we may be culturally a little different than you, but I think that we're economically the same, and I think we share the rural land-based values of our area. I think we have a lot more in common than we have different.
Mm-hmm. I do, too. I feel that, The thing that gets to me is that the money that's involved here is what's calling the shots. It's not the grassroots people down here that's concerned with the earth and living here. It's the people that don't live here and make money off of it. They don't care. And that's a real valid issue.
You know, I'd like to have both of you back when Peggy Iris from Wild Iris comes on in August. And she's now the head of a company that does sustainable forestry, and I'd like the two of you to have a conversation around that. Until that time, I think many of us would like to just see what's left remain standing and have men who have been in the woods taking those trees down using the same equipment to restore forest land. And I wondered how you felt about that, those kinds of jobs, if there was some kind of wave equivalency.
Well, that's it already happened now. The industry has closed itself down. Now, in my opinion, the reason that they've closed themselves down is to protect their supply and drive out the independent loggers. And then when they've got all the independent loggers out and there's only corporations like Louisiana Pacific, George Pacific, Weyerhaeuser, they'll leave a few independent logging contractors to log their harder areas and protect themselves insurance-wise, but at the same time, they'll have dried it up enough that they can control their supply, and by the laws economically of supply and demand, they'll dribble out timber at a small basis to keep the woods products driven up at a high price. They protect their market by now claiming that the industry is going flat. I believe when you get right down to it, you'll find that the I want to say bureaucrats, but that's not it. The corporations have actually used the environmentalists as a tool to achieve things that they want done that's not apparent on the surface, that they make it look like they want to close down, which is a bad thing for them, it looks like, on the surface. But if it dries up their supply and protects their supply, in the long run, it's beneficial to them. You see, so I think there's a whole structure at play here that's much, like I keep referring to, that's much, much larger than just the grassroots people down here trying to swing wild at the windmill. That there's a powerful machine above us that's trying to negate everything that we can do, even on a united front, environmentalists, workers, and loggers, and et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I'm really amazed at what you're saying, Virgil, because when I first met you and Jim at the Y, we had the feeling that we were on opposite sides of an issue, and in this studio it doesn't sound like that at all.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what do you have any ideas what we can do about that? I mean, you know, obviously we're trying everything we can think of, and from your point of view, how can we take the land back? How can we take our lives back?
Well, as far as the loggers standing in the woods doing things that are productive to the forest, that's not going to happen because they've done drove us out. What professions have opened up now as a lack of logging is firewood gathering, cutting duff down and brush down, thinning out the trees, et cetera, et cetera. But we'll find that there's been a foreign workforce hired in there. And now, as far as the corporations are concerned, they can pay unskilled labor prices for skilled labor and thin their trees and manicure our forests and get them in a good productive shape using a workforce that's outside what's available here in America. I'll put it that way.
You know, LP claims, according to these figures they came up with the other day, that 4.2% of their trees are 85 years or older. And that's all I'm seeing going out these days. You know, last year and the year before, you saw a lot of little trees from LP because they were just liquidating everything. But it's even more disturbing this year because everything I see on an LP truck, you know, is a grandmother tree. And based on the what we call the grandmother law, anything older than your grandmother ought to be saved. And thinking of the issue of loggers' pride, because that's something that really stands out to me about loggers is the pride that they have in in the work they do, and I think that's being robbed by the corporations. It's hard to be proud. I wonder if there's any feeling among loggers about, for the pride of our profession, we don't cut old growth trees. Is there any feeling like that among loggers?
Can I just say, Virg, before I get you the opportunity to answer back, we have a phone call that's been trying to get through for a real long time. Just hold on another couple minutes while Virg responds, and we'll get you in this conversation, caller.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, the answer is, how do loggers feel about cutting old-growth trees? Is there any feeling among them that they should or could refuse to do so?
I prefer to work in old-growth trees.
Why is that, Jim Murphy?
I get a big charge out of the big timber, conquering the big timber. I myself, being different than Virgil, he's philosophical about what's going on, the upper mechanics of it. I prefer to pit myself against nature, per se. I prefer big clear cuts with big logs. And the bigger the clear cut,
but
more
what about
challenge.
But what about giant restoration efforts, rivers
giant
that have gone
efforts.
Wild?
But what about your kids if they're almost out of old growth? I mean, I don't even think that if we had cut this reasonably from the beginning, we wouldn't have destroyed the forest.
Hopefully.
There wouldn't have been anything wrong with cutting old growth, but now that there's nothing left.
Hopefully,
granted, this is true.
Hopefully, if my kids grow up to work in the woods, they can be on the first boat to Siberia.
And they're going to have to.
Well, rubles cash as well as green dollar bills. And
well, I think that's an interesting issue, in as much as if they've had absolutely, they being the corporations, have had absolutely no respect or consideration for what they're doing to our forest, just hit and run, rape it, tear it up, it doesn't matter. What difference, as soon as they get there, if you got the same powers that be, now they start logging in the rainforest or they start logging in Siberia, unless they change the methods of logging and make some changes that's healthy for the environment overall, they're still going to rape and plunder in Siberia, the Philippines, it doesn't matter. It's an economic thing here that's at work that's calling the shots, not what's healthy for Mother Earth.
Let's get this caller in this conversation. Hi, thank you, caller, for being so patient. You're on Fourth Gate now.
Hi. I wanted to hark back to what Virgil said about money being the control and that it's higher than the grassroots. I think that this program this morning is part of an ongoing coalition that arises from the souls of the workers and the environmentalists, and seeing how much we have in common makes us, in the words of the song, be in charge. We are in charge. If Virgil wouldn't be in the radio station this morning if it weren't for these grassroots hijinks that call attention and make public the machinations of the moneyed power. And the more we scream this from the rooftops and the treetops, the more there will be a true coalition. And thank God for Virgil, and thank God for Judy. Judy understands the workers, and that's the important thing, and sets this spectrum. It interests me that the loggers I know refer to trees as he. Okay.
Stay on. Caller, this is Mary Korta, Willits Poet Laureate. Jim, I wanted you to talk back and forth with her because, you know, one of our tree sitters, I think it was Dark Moon, said as he was there alone after they had harassed Badger off of his tree so they could continue poking that road through this forest land through dreadful measures, by the way. He said, as one of the guys went home, he screamed up with a raised fist, "The desertification of Mendocino County, hooray!" Taking great joy in what he was doing in changing our climate, in destroying this temperate forest land. Do you have any sense of how our region fits in the global picture and global weather patterns?
None whatsoever, and I actually would let you think about that. I'm more concerned about conquering the forest.
Well, how do you feel about cutting pecker poles?
Not at all.
So would you refuse to do so?
Sure. I feel that is below my technical skill.
Yeah, I think it's shameful. And it is. It is below your technical skill.
But I have real heavy feelings about what your technical skill is directed at. I mean, we really need these ancient trees to remain standing for future generations. I'd like to see you put your technical skill to other ventures. What is it going to take in your own sense of self, other than trees to chop down?
I haven't figured that out myself.
Let's give him some help. Thank you. Do you want to continue, Mary, and then I'll let in this other call?
I think I'll just listen over the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. This call may be for us. Hello, you're on Fourth Gate Gazette.
Hi. I just want to comment that these two gentlemen, when they were at the Y, they had these signs out. I think it was, forest raper, right?
Yeah, I think Virgil especially has really taken a giant step since when they showed up at the Y.
Well, maybe they have a sense of humor.
Or maybe they have a sense of humor. Go ahead, caller.
Okay, well, I just did a very short little poem by virtue of their inspiration with their signs, and I wonder if I could share it. It's
sure.
Very long. It says, to LP forest rapers, you call us does 1 to 100, and threaten to take away our homes for our caring and showing you taking away the homes of the deer, the indigenous does of the forest. We have known for years the fear of you men who would gouge the earth, the pillage and plunder, leaving it, us, wounded behind. While other men now will sing us songs of water and air and gentle growing things reaching to spirit, we would open ourselves to them. We spirits of new songs, chanting of old ways, to leave the growing things on their course to eternity, the children's children's heritage. Sanctity for your soul. Sanctify the ground. Sanctify the life, the balance. Human, know yourself for what you are, a doe, a creature with this earth. What base spirit has overtaken your heart that pushes you to destroy your own home? Forest raper, convert your soul. You too are a doe. Thanks.
That is so beautiful. This is one of the does being sued by LP. Virgil, what you inspired. That's incredible.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. How have you, Virgil, I feel like you've really changed just over this 2-day period.
I've been the same way all along. That's a nice poem, and my heart goes out for him. But, I get called forest raper and tree murderer and tree killer. I'm held captive. I'm ordered to do what I'm ordered to do under corporate guidelines of what's most productive way of logging. The hell with the environment, yet you're calling my profession overall a bunch of tree rapers. You see what I mean? You're calling me. I'm doing what's called me to do my job. It's not up to me to call how I do the job, the method used in the logging. And there is suspension methods and ways of logging that partial cuts, things that can be done that makes the forest an ongoing thing where you take out the sick and the diseased and the injured trees and you leave a healthy forest and things keep growing, but not under the corporate way who calls the shots. Now it's not that way right now.
And that's why it's so important that I think a lot of environmentalists, particularly city environmentalists, didn't understand this. Many people seem to now. That one of the mill workers put it to me. He says, we are forced to be unwilling co-conspirators in the death of the forest. So not only that, certainly you're not to blame for your, I used to build yuppie houses out of old growth redwood, and if I had refused to do that, I would be fired too. And as a single woman with a high school degree, making 12 bucks an hour, that was the best job that I could get. And so I really understand that economic position and the fact that you don't have control over it. But the irony of it in this case, though, is that the corporations are making the loggers cut themselves out of work. And, there's a lot of reasons why people are not in a position to be able to fight back about that. But that's, to me, that's the essence of it, because we can stand up and wave our hands and say, don't do this, don't do this. But, back in the 19-teens, the loggers organized and just refused to do it. And so for the sake, even, although I don't agree with you about cutting old growth, Jim, even for your ability to continue to cut old growth, it is that's the only way that I really can see that this can ultimately happen, is that just like in Russia, when they refused to fire the guns, the whole community has to stand together against these corporations, or I just don't see how any way that we can break their power. And they're the ones who are eliminating the lifestyle of the loggers, not us.
Yeah, well, they don't care, though, because if the forest is hit and run, surely to goodness the logger's job can be hit and run, too.
We have two people trying to get in this conversation. Hello, you're on Fourth Gate Gazette.
Hi. Well, it's mighty interesting to hear the contrast between the two loggers. I always had a hard time understanding city environmentalists until I listened to Jim a little bit more carefully. And your attitude that those forests are yours to just cut down and massacre, or not, you don't probably see it as massacre, but to take them out with your technical skill. Well, I need to tell you something. That land belongs to me as well as to you. That belongs to my children as well as to your children. And my children need the rainfall that those old-growth forests are the little bit that's left of the second-growth forests, old-growth forests. Come on now, they're gone. My children and I and the future generations need the rain that's going to be produced by them, and need the fish that depend upon the integrity of the streams and the integrity of the surrounding lands. You don't have the right, as far as I'm concerned, to destroy just because you have a technical thrill or technical ability out of it. And, you've made me a lot more sympathetic today to these city people who come up here and kind of laugh at us when we say, well, the workers have a point of view and need to earn a living, too. If your point of view is that you just have the right to go out and take it because you have the ability to take it, well, I'll tell you, you've really done a lot to alienate me towards the sympathy that I had until today for the working people around here.
Jim?
Well, I can see as though we're not going to be friends. As I'd spoken before, all I can stand on is my abilities, and my particular abilities in this life cycle is that I learned very early that to kill trees, and that's all I ever strive to do. My earliest thoughts in life, even though I didn't grow up in the Pacific Northwest, my parents did. My mother, during the war, cut timber. All of her sisters owned logging trucks and worked in logging camps in Oregon. Some of my first thoughts were I wanted to be a cable logger in the woods. I wanted to be a high climber.
So it's almost like stripping you of a religion. It's a very deep lifestyle. I mean, you're serious when you say the lifestyle of the logger is going away, and that's something precious that needs protection also.
Yeah, and I'd like to...
And I'm saying, how can we redirect the same skills and change the target?
I'd like to say to that last caller that maybe his problem isn't with Jim and what Jim wants to do. His problem is would might be better addressed through his congressman and the political means to make your voice heard, to make sure that your environment is protected. But then we all know that's a joke, because the government is not run by people anymore. Government is run by economics, and therefore it is a corrupt government, and you cannot really expect something that's an unrealistic expectation, which is a government that responds to issues on a need level rather than on a money level.
And a court.
Right. So I don't think we can look to government, but I mean, I understand that Jim needs to earn a living and to feed his family, just as you and I do. But on the other hand, you know, I can't accept that you're so indifferent to my survival needs, too, because you have this belief that, or you have this historical basis. Well, I'll tell you, the world is a changing place, and it's a lot more crowded, and it's a very different place than the time of your parents, and you've got to learn to make some adjustments, just like I've had to learn to make some adjustments, too. I mean, some of the skills that we have just plain are harmful right now, and those skills, you know, we have to get them up. You don't sound like a stupid guy. You sound like someone who could learn to do something else with your life. At some point, you know, if what you're doing just has a real destructive effect on the rest of us, then I gotta say, hey, you know, maybe it's time to start to put your mind and your body to work in a different direction. I won't keep you on the air anymore, but I wish you'd take that one to heart and give that some thought.
Let's make room for this other caller.
I want to say one thing first, though. I want to comment that although Verge looks like he just walked in from a job, Jim is perfectly clean, and I want to know how much work you actually have cutting old growth trees in this county.
I'm drawing unemployment right now.
That's what I thought.
Caller, you're on now.
I'm on SSI.
Oh, hi, this is Naomi. This show is music to my ears to hear all of this conversation, because I think it's really a needed thing, and I hope that it will carry over into the hearings on this Saturday at the Forest Advisory Committee, because it's really time for us to put our heads together and see what we can, as the Indian said, see what we can make of our future for our children. And I wanted to thank Jim especially for being so forthright in his comments and saying how he feels, because I think we need to hear that, and we need to talk about it. And that's, he's giving us that opportunity. I thank you, Jim. You know, I think Judy, you know, she probably kind of wrapped it up there when she said, well, how much old growth is there left? But, you know, what is left, the resource that's left, is your skills. And your skills are very needed and very, you know, this is the part we don't want to lose, because if we want to do some restoration work in the woods, we're going to need people that know the woods and know the mechanics of working in the woods, and having the skill to cut a big old tree is something that if we want to raise forests, if we want to get our forests back to where they produce old trees, then we're going to need people that know how to cut them. So I would say that your skill, you know, it needs to be exercised in a different way for a while, but not lost, in the hope that we will have enough. I mean, it's, just think of it. Think of having the old growth trees enough to employ you again. That would be a dream for both timber workers and environmentalists.
Right, right. And that's a very good thing that you've brought up there, that as long as these corporations can keep people at odds with each other down here at the grassroots level, they don't want a united front. They want the workers against the environmentalists, et cetera, right down the line, because it makes splinter groups. And what we're doing here today, I'm hoping that when I speak for the average working Joe, that we're opening up a means of communication between some of the working people and the environmentalists, so that we can deal with a broader agenda. And this is why I'd like to say, from the working man's standpoint, that it's very important that we open a dialogue and present a united front, so that our jobs are protected and we can keep doing the job that we've trained ourselves to do. And if these forests have been mismanaged for a century or more now, it's time to stop now while there's still enough old growth left to produce the seed stock and stuff, if it stops immediately. What's left is there's whole strips of states running 60 to 120 miles wide, we'll say, from the northernmost tip of the continental United States down to the Big Sur country. 120 mile wide strip has already been logged out of the most prime forest that there is in the world. And if it doesn't stop right now, there's not even going to be seed stock left. It's amazing to me that something hasn't been done about it before now. And I see part of the reason why is the fracture pressure to keep everything split apart that the corporations have put up. And it's going to take a united front from the workers, the environmentalists, the political structure. It's going to take a whole bunch to get a control of the situation to stop, not only for the sake of the rain that the forests produce, but you got outfits like Monsanto Chemical pouring in billions and billions of gallons of PCBs into our water supply because they call the shots in their industry, not the Environmental Protection Agency, the logging industry. They don't care how they log because they call the shots, not the environmentalists in that industry. And right on down the line, every industry is now corrupt because it no longer responds to political pressure. It responds as a puppet to economic structures. And this is what the environmentalists, as well as the working man, is up against.
You silent for so long in a couple of years now.
I'm trying to give them a chance to talk.
Yeah, right?
I'm restraining myself from interrupting every minute.
Right. She doesn't have much to say when I'm making her point.
Right.
Her.
There you go. The one thing I do want to say is we got to keep the timber workers in this community, and when they leave, the yuppies are right on their tail. I mean, if we want to keep the rural value of our community, whether like the man who is, you know, alienated by Jim, no matter how you may feel personally about individual loggers, I think that if we're going to change the whole character of this area, if the loggers, if the rural working people are driven out of this area, the yuppies are coming right in. They're putting the first vineyard in on Highway 20, and that's what we got to worry about.
We have another caller trying to get through. Noemi, did you have a final point you wanted to make?
There's something that I wanted to ask.
Okay.
Leave this question and I'll get up. I would like to know from Virgil and Jim how they feel about the Forest Advisory Committee recommendations, if they know about them, and if they feel like that would help solve our problem of stopping the corporate destruction and starting a locally controlled restoration. And if they don't, you know, if they have a problem with it and they don't think that's going to solve the problem, I'd like to know what they would suggest.
Thank you for the question. Virgil?
I wasn't paying any attention to the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. How do you feel
about the Forest Advisory Committee rules? Do you know about them, and how do you feel if you do?
I haven't studied them, so I'm ignorant on the subject, so I'll just have to say if it's part of the existing political structure, it's corrupt, and therefore I put no lot of say-so in what they got to say.
Okay. I just got a message from the office. Many people are trying to get through. Four people in the last 3 minutes called the office. Caller, next caller, you're on the air. You could start calling back the studio again.
Okay. I'm calling about a couple of things. One is conquering the forest, which somebody said back there a ways. And I want to bring up the matter of the otter washer. There's a comedian who does a routine about a guy who talks about his life as an otter washer, that he's an otter washer and he needs oil spills because his lifestyle demands, you know, that he keep on washing these otters. And this working man ethic, which is a working man ethic, and I think the reason we're seeing such concern about timber workers' jobs is that they are all men. The notion that if we keep a few guys in corks and galluses kind of walking around, that somehow we'll stop the yuppification of this county is silly. It's not going to happen. There, you have no trees, you have no loggers. Anybody with a job in this county that's not making up motel beds is a marginal person or is part of the problem, except for the 300 loggers or whatever they are. I want to suggest that conquering the forest, which is, I think, it's as ingrained in people as it is in chickens to scratch, that if you see the disorder of nature, you want to clean it up and pull the underbrush out and, you know, rake it like you did when you were a kid, that there are other ways to bring order to the world. And for young men, there are other ways to engage in warrior kinds of actions. If we ever needed guys who are really good at engineering and physical work and at standing up against impossible odds, now is the time that we need it. But the forest is not what needs to be conquered anymore. That was maybe true when there was the Great Western Forest, and it was dark and it was unknown and whatnot. It's not a lifestyle that you're really talking about, I don't think. It's kind of an addiction, maybe.
But thank you. A wilderness
that is gone. Everybody has left is marginal. It's going to be something else now. It's a great, great show.
Thank you, caller. I want Jim to respond, but first I have to let you all know that you're listening to KZYX Philo and that the preceding hour of Fourth Gate Gazette was brought to you by the members of KZYX and by Adornment in Mendocino. Jim, I mean, that was an eloquent speech that caller made.
Yes, it was. As far as being a warrior, I consider myself a warrior against the woods, sure. The other trade that I've honed and what you could think about maybe putting a lot of these rigging hands to doing is drilling offshore oil wells. I worked almost 2 years in the oil fields, and I believe that that's a whole nother avenue to open.
I wanted to say that I don't think that I didn't mean that if we keep loggers out there cutting old growth, we'll stop the yuppification of the county. I never meant that at all. What I mean is that if we don't have a land-based economy with working people working in the woods, and what I think that we need to be doing in these woods, there's tons of work to be done, but it's restoring the woods and bringing them back to health.
But Jim is talking about acts of exploitation.
Right. And I think that,
the logging that's going on in the woods right now is a form of exploitation of the most grossest kind.
I mean, I want to know whether Jim, using the same skills, would be able to approach the forest as part of the emergency medical team as the healer. Or, I mean, is part of your psyche really attached to making the loud noise as they come down?
Yeah, but if the timber was managed in a fashion that it was there for us to do with like that, it wouldn't be a bad thing. It would be a good thing if we're harvesting in a fashion that's overall productive to the forest. See, and this is the thing. There's still room for people like us loggers to get out there and work and log. It's just that it's not productive. It's not as productive a way of getting logs as what these corporations are used to. And they don't want to bend. It costs them a little more bucks, and they're not going to give up a few bucks.
Okay. Yeah, but the money's not going to us. It's going to Portland. It's going to Texas. It's going to Atlanta.
Yes.
If we took that off, if we no longer had to pay Harry Merlo's $5 million a year salary, there'd be we could log a lot less in a lot more sensitive manner and make a better living at it.
We just lost a phone call. Caller, call right back, and I'm going to put you smack on the air. Give them an opportunity. Either of you have a comment while we're waiting for that call we just lost?
Just that the focus be that there is a structure. Again, I say it again, that there's a structure at play here that is going to take a very united front. And the caller that said that the grassroots movement has it's where it's at. It's where you're going to make a voice loud enough to change the structures that are at work here. It's a shame that people, working people and environmental people, both committed in the heart, have been vied against each other by the corporations. That to me is no longer a viable thing. I want to see that all people get together and start doing things about our country, not only in the forest, but on our beaches, on these oceans where they're dumping out chemicals. And it's an overall picture. It's not just the rainforest. If they're doing this, if the corporations are doing this to our watersheds and the things that they've done in the last 20 and 30 years, knowing that the timber is drying up because of the environmental pressure that's being put upon them, if they're doing that, it's just an example of what's going on in the chemical industry, the atomic industry level, what they're doing with their waste, burying it in landfills instead of paying to put it away in the correct manner. It goes real deep into this country, what they've done, and I've looked and looked, and I know no way to address the situation where I can have impact on it as an individual other than get involved in little grassroots movements and say your piece.
Thank you. We have one more call for these gentlemen. Hello, caller. You're on Fourth Gate.
Hi, this is Luna calling from Albion. I really appreciate the show. Thanks to you all for beginning and continuing this dialogue. I think it's extremely important that these different elements of the community come together. I think we all really agree that we have to figure out some new strategies for survival. I kind of heard a little bit of nostalgia for the old days when one of the guys there was talking about how even his mother drove a logging truck. We know that not everybody that used to support themselves to the extent they did in the woods can do it right now, and I think we're all trying to figure out how our kids can have a good life.
I think one of the interesting things is that Luna, who is a leader in the watershed protection movement, came out of a labor family where her dad was an organizer in the labor movement and are using those skills in the watershed movement.
That's also my background.
And that's Judy's background.
Now, and there were actually some parallels. We're actually, to what happened to the steel industry, in 20 years past, because the corporate America and the government rebuilt the steel industry in Japan and Germany and shot ourselves in the foot, so to speak, and the steel industry in the United States ate it. Well, they can't take the forests away from us. They may end up selling them to Japan, but we do end up with the forest. So I have a real specific thing. While appreciating and feeling we have to continue to find out where we agree and where we disagree and how we can come up with new strategies, economic strategies for survival for all of our kids, whether they're going to continue working in the woods or not. The real specific thing now is we all agree that they're going for the last shreds of it real damn fast, and even sustained yield is going to be moot if we have nothing to sustain for another, 100 years. I'm involved in a project right now of doing critical habitat mapping. I'm asking anybody, anywhere, in any of the North Coast, I'm particularly focused in Albion and Salmon Creek, but we're doing mappings all over. If you know where the second growth areas are, if you know of any of the older trees, we need to get them on the map now so we can figure out where we're going to hold the line and where we can negotiate before it goes down. So you can call me at 937-3639 early in the morning, or drop a card to our WAPA at Box 661 Albion. We need on-ground truthing. We have the THP maps. We really need to know where the second growth habitat is, which is our critical habitat in this county, where the older trees are. And we need to continue this dialogue, but we also have to hold the line before it all goes down and it's just a moot point and we end up with baby trees all over the place and we're all just going to be, there's nothing going to be left to sustain.
Right.
So that's my plea right now. Give me a call at 3639. We need to do this mapping now. And thanks to all of you for starting to get these issues out and figuring how we can work together.
One more call for you gentlemen, and then we're going to switch to the second part of the show. I've had lots of does ask me if they couldn't have a conversation with one of the lawyers on the slap suit. Hello, caller. You're on Fourth Gate.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to call and say thank you very much for the show. I appreciate Virgil and Jim very much for being on the show and having the courage to come forth. I think it is time that there be some big changes in the perspective that people have all over the United States, all over the world, of course. And I wanted to report that there is a meeting, an organization flying in this evening from New Mexico, a group of people who have been working all over South America, Central America, and Northern America on a variety of different issues called Lighthawk. It's the Environmental Air Force. They're meeting tonight at 7 o'clock. With a group of people in the area, everyone's invited at Real Goods, 7 o'clock this evening. Tomorrow morning at 8 or 9 o'clock, there'll be opportunity for individuals to go up and look at some of the environment around us that's been despoiled by a variety of clear cuts and what have you. Lighthawk is a great organization that's done a lot of work, environmental work all over the place, and I'd just like to encourage everyone to come to that if they possibly can.
Thank you. We have our own Lighthawk, and actually we have two Lighthawks. Lewis Bigfoot started piecing together aerial photographs of these watersheds way before CDF, and Nick Wilson has done a lot with aerial photography here on our site. Virg and Jim, I'm going to give you the last word before we switch
over.
Well,
I'd like to encourage everyone out there that's listening to this radio program to do a little investigation on their own and find out what's happening to their own country. Right now, in Alaska, the logging's shut down. There's no white owls in spotted owls there in Alaska, but yet all the logging's shut down. Why? It's shut down in Oregon and Washington because of the spotted owl. Well, we can live with that. But my question is, why is it shut down right now in Alaska when there's no need to? It's all part of a big, almost a conspiracy, if you will, by the corporations to do exactly as they want to do and not respond to anybody. We've got our cake and we've got the money to do as we want to do, and I just encourage everyone listening to pick up their phone, call their congressman, call their senators, go down to the little local meetings, do something. They're robbing you and your children and me and my children of America.
We're having community meetings at Touchstone Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock. Hopefully you gentlemen will join some of those. And then, Jim, because you are trying so hard to keep this this Lifeway alive, why don't you have the last word?
I would like to find somebody that's going to Siberia. I'm going to start saving my money, and I'm going to get me a plane ticket and fly over there and go back to logging. At least I won't have tree huggers and people sitting in trees hollering bad things at me.
Don't count on that.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
And I'm gonna slip them a note. August 18th, I'd like you back. That's the show with the Wild Irish people who are doing sustainable logging up in Humboldt County. Hopefully you'll join us for that. Let me play you a tune from Redwood Summer as I usher in my next group of guests.